The following message was given at Grace Community Church in Minden, Nevada.
Jeff Johnson is the founding pastor of Grace Bible Church in Conway, Arkansas, and he also started the Grace Bible Theological Seminary, and they have sort of got some notoriety recently with new faculty members and guys like James White and Owen Strand. And so, and then also, Jeff started Free Grace Press, which back in the early days, how many books a year did you do?
We did about one a year.
About one a year. How many do you do now?
Two a month.
Two a month. Yeah. And so they do reprints, they do new books, and Jeff is just, he's a dear friend and he's a good brother, and we're glad that he's here.
Well, happy birthday. 28 years is a thing to be greatly thankful for. God's faithfulness to your church and giving you good pastors, and I hear great things about your church. Just thankful to be here. Brian wanted me to teach y'all something before I got started. Y'all been saying Nevada wrong. And it's time to correct your pronunciation. Nevada. Nevada. Everybody knows in Arkansas that's how you say it. Well, tonight I'm going to kind of modify a lecture. I teach the doctrine of God at Grace Bible Theological Seminary, and it's kind of apologetic course, the first section of the class. And so tonight, I'm not necessarily preaching tonight, but as the lessons go on, I'll get into more preaching mode. By Sunday morning, I'll be preaching. I do think there's a difference between teaching, lecturing, and preaching. And so I don't want to be you to confuse what I'm doing tonight. It's more putting on your thinking caps. Now, in preaching, you have to think. Good, solid, biblical preaching will challenge your soul and challenge your life, but it will make you think. And I want you to think tonight, but I don't have a lot of practical application because these lectures and sermons that I have kind of all fit together. So look at this as point one of a broader lesson, and then we'll get into the application on Sunday morning. So tonight is more of laying the foundation, groundwork, about not just who God is. We'll get into a little bit of who God is, but really what we're going to look at is how do we know God? Not who God is, but how does this knowledge of God get to us? How do we become aware of God? How does God speak to us? How do we learn? And do we have to have revelation? Do we have to have divine communication for us to know God? Or can we, without revelation, can we ascertain, gain a knowledge of God, a correct knowledge of God? Or if we're not submitted to revelation, are we going to create a false God, such as pantheism or deism or some other false idea of who God is? Because I do believe how we learn about God will determine the God we learn about. So it's important that we know how we know God. Now, I have three boys, and I remember when my oldest was around five or six, and I liked that he was honest to me, but he didn't know that if there was a God. I'm like, I have an atheist for a kid? Of course, I don't really believe in true atheism, but here my son is saying, how do I know if there's really a God? And he's 5 or 6 years old, and here I've written a book on apologetics, and what am I going to tell my own five-year-old about God? And, you know, and the question that he had is a legitimate question that we all have. If I can't see God, then how do I know he's real? If I can't experience him, you have five senses, and if he's not discernible among the five senses, then how can I be certain that there is a God? That was his dilemma. And I think it's a legitimate question. So we want to kind of explore that. And tonight we're going to, kind of negatively, we're going to look at how we don't know God, how we can't learn about God, the false ways of trying to figure out God. And there are three ways that the world looks to discern who God is and to come to a knowledge of God. And I think all three of these ways we're going to look at tonight lead to a faulty view of God. It's a faulty epistemology, that is, it's a faulty way of knowing truth, or at least knowing about ultimate truth such as God. And if you try to find out God through these three paths or these three methods, you're going to end up with a false God. And so we don't want to go these paths, but we need to know what those paths are. Now, if you want to look at a text, as I said, this is not a sermon, but if you wanted a text for to kind of summarize what we're going to look at tonight, is 1 Corinthians 1:21. 1 Corinthians 1:21, and it talks about the wisdom of God and how God has arranged that there is a proper way of knowing God and an improper way of knowing God. And if you go the false way of trying to ascertain or learn about who God is, you're not going to discover God. They're dead ends. 1 Corinthians 1:21, it says, "For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God." Now, God is so crafty and wise that he's arranged that man in his pure wisdom, in his wisdom alone, can't come to the wisdom of God. That's how wise God is. That man in his wisdom, that includes philosophers, that includes you without divine revelation. That includes all of us if we're left to ourselves. We're like in a fishbowl and God's outside the fishbowl. We're stuck inside of that fishbowl. And how are we going to learn about anything other than the water that surrounds us and the little environment that we're in? How do we know what's underneath the fishbowl? If we try to study the fishbowl, how are we going to discern everything else outside the fishbowl? That's the question. If we're here on this little ball called earth, and God's not living on the earth, but he's in heaven, he's transcendent, he's not a part of the creation, he's independent of the creation, how are we who are in this fishbowl called the earth, how are we going to know about God who's outside the fishbowl? God's arranged it that unless God communicates to us, unless God comes and descends, that we in our own finite, feeble wisdom, we're going to end up creating a God after our own likeness. We're going to create a false identity of who God is. And we need to know the three ways that the world, sadly, and many Christians implement these three ways. And I want to address these things so that we don't fall into this method. The first is science. I do believe science demands there is a God. It presupposes God. That without the existence of God, science doesn't make sense. But to say that science proves the existence of God or demands the existence of God is not telling us what this God is. So it's one thing to say we believe in the existence of God through natural science. Another thing to say natural science can give us an explanation, a definition of God. So we're going to look at why natural science is faulty. Second, we're going to look at how philosophy, and there's various strands of philosophical approaches. There's three major philosophical approaches, but all three of them end in failure. We'll look at that. Then maybe we'll see that we can combine natural science with philosophy and kind of combine the two methods into a third method. And we'll call that philosophical theology, or we can call it natural theology. We can call it what we want, but it's a blending of science and philosophy together. And maybe by blending them together, we can create a true picture of who God is. And I'm going to say, no, even that builds a idol. And hopefully next lesson, tomorrow morning, we'll see that we're dependent upon revelation, both natural revelation and special revelation, that God has to communicate to us. But it's he who is the author of the communication, and it's he who reveals it to us. And we must begin by submitting to communication, not building from the ground up our own understanding of God. So we can't rise to God. God has to descend to us. He has to enter into the fishbowl and speak. We are never going to be able to jump out of the fishbowl and discover what's outside the fishbowl on our own. We need divine communication. So let's look and see how natural science is not revelation. Philosophy is not revelation. And natural theology, or the combination of natural science and philosophy, is not revelation. First of all, natural science doesn't get us to any picture of who God is. Natural science is based upon your five senses. You got your taste, you got your smell, you got your hearing, you got your touch. It's the things that are physical, material. And so all that your five senses are able to discern or to test or to observe are the things that are material, matter. And if you're committed to natural science as the only method of knowledge, now it is a method. God has created the world, and we know a lot about the world through science. Science is legitimate. I don't think Fauci is science, but I do think science is legitimate. Thank the Lord for doctors, scientists. Thank the Lord that we can learn a lot about the physical world in which we live. Your mechanic is somewhat of a scientist. Your cooks are somewhat scientists. We need scientists. In fact, we're all scientists in some measure or another. But however, it's one thing to say science is a legitimate method of knowing the world. It's another thing, science is a legitimate method of knowing God. But the problem with those who are committed to science and knowing God is it leads them to come to what is known in the philosophical world as empiricism, which is a commitment, a pre-commitment that the only knowledge that can be gained is that which can be gained through science. Science is the only valid form of knowing anything. Many of the atheists today are committed scientists. And they say, whatever science cannot teach us, then we cannot know. Technically, these are called positivists. And they're committed to science. And for instance, William Clifford said, who was in the 19th century, he was one of the leading empiricists of the day. He says, it is wrong always, everywhere, and for everyone to believe anything upon insignificant evidence. He didn't realize that 10 or 15 years later he would be made fun of because that very sentence cannot be proven by science. So he's making a non-scientific claim that you can only know anything by science, but how do you know that? You see, it's self-defeating. Bertrand Russell was asked, why do you not believe in God? He says, there's simply just not enough evidence. If there was evidence, I would believe in God, but I don't see him. God would have to manifestly reveal himself in some physical way. That's because God is transcendent. God is not a part of creation. He's outside of creation. If he was a part of creation, it would be pantheism, right? It wouldn't be a transcendent God who created the world out of nothing. So natural science, if that's the only method of knowing God, then we can't get to the God of the Bible. We'll get to some form of pantheism. But, you know, this idea that natural science or empiricism is the only knowledge that we can have is that which we can gain from senses is really trying to understand the universe by understanding the particulars. And one of the greatest questions in all of philosophy, throughout all of history, is the question of the one and the many. It's puzzled everybody, is which is ultimate, the one or the many? Now, relativists today say, hey, what's ultimate is the particulars. There's no one thing that unifies the universe. in the word universe implies that there's something that brings everything, trees, animals, humanity, everything, the stars, the moon, everything is somehow connected. There's something that unites everything together. There's something, there's one thing that unifies all the diversity in the world. Then the other says, no, it's just pure diversity. There's nothing that unifies. And so there's this great battle, which is more important? And for scientists, they say, well, there's nothing. Scientists can't get to a unifying principle. Now, various scientists in history, some of the earlier philosophers like Thales says water was the ultimate reality. Water. Some said fire. Some said earth. Some said air. But ultimately, you're trying to understand everything by what is the ultimate thing that everything can be reduced down to. In the end, scientists have concluded, even Einstein tried to find a mathematical equation to unify the universe. What is the equation that can, you know, he figured out gravity. And it's amazing, you know, the movement of the planets can be brought down to a mathematical equation. He said, there's got to be an ultimate mathematical equation that explains everything. He never found that equation. Maybe there is one. I don't know. But even that is mathematics is not anything that's physical. Scientists and committed empiricists cannot prove that logic and mathematics even exist because it's not something that can be tested. So the problem with being a materialist or empiricist as trying to discover God is it is not going to get you to a God, and it cannot. It's limited. Science is limited. It's good in what it can tell you. It can tell you how to make apple pie. It can tell you how to change your alternator. It can tell you what's wrong with your kidneys and all kinds of wonderful things that we need to know, and it's important to know. Science is an important thing to understand and to study, but one thing science cannot do is tell you anything about the attributes of God. And we need to realize the limitations of science and not look at science as the answer to our understanding of who God is. The truth is, science cannot be the only way of knowing anything. Because science is dependent upon math, logic. And really, you need your scientists to be ethical, too. If you can't trust them, then... if you can't trust Fauci, you question everything, right? So really, scientists need something that's non-material for their own profession. You need logic, you need ethics, you need mathematics. Gravity works on a mathematical equation. All of science can be reduced to a mathematical equation. It's quite phenomenal. But math transcends matter. It's something that you can't put in a test tube. It's something you can't examine. You can't touch and sense. So empiricism as a philosophy of knowledge falls apart on itself. It's limited in what it tells us. It's good, but it's not sufficient in getting us to God. And if we did believe in empiricism as the only form of knowledge, it would lead to all kinds of crazy problems in our lives. Those who are committed atheists, because you know, if you're committed empiricist, then you're a committed naturalist. That means all you know that exists, what is ultimate reality, is something that is natural, and your mind is a byproduct of your brain, and your brain is just a byproduct of what you ate for breakfast. And therefore, you really don't have freedom of the will, you don't have volition, because you're just a consequence of physical chemicals within your brain. And that's why modern-day psychology is trying to fix people's problems and address behavioral issues, not by holding people accountable, but saying, hey, it was your environment, how you were raised, or it's some type of chemical imbalance in your brain that needs to be adjusted. And this is what happens if you believe in God and all the, you do not believe in God and all you believe is in this world. You end up not only pushing God aside, but you push off true ethics aside. And then you end up, like Bertrand Russell says, why do you spank your kids? Why do you correct your kids? Why do you discipline your kids? It's not something you don't... if your car breaks down, he says, you don't lecture your car and say, bad car. You take your car to the mechanic. And if your kid's not behaving right, you don't need to say, bad kid. You need to take your kid to the psychiatrist and get them fixed. Because it's not an ethical issue, it's a physical issue. Because if you're committed empiricist or naturalist, everything comes down to matter. And it's pretty persuasive in the world we live in. But with this commitment, it can't get us to God. It doesn't lead to the attributes of God. So no, empiricism is not sufficient in telling us who God is. So we don't go that route. Well, okay, let's push empiricism away for now. Maybe it's not empiricism. Maybe it's not our five senses. Maybe it's philosophy. And I'm not going to look at every form of philosophy tonight. We don't have time. But I'll look at the main one that philosophers try to get to God through, and it's called reason. Now, I'm not critiquing logic. We all use logic. So when I'm critiquing rationalism, I'm not critiquing logic. I'm using logic in my talk tonight. And you're using logic in your understanding of my talk. You're evaluating what I'm saying through the use of logic. Logic is good. Logic is a part of who God is. So I'm not critiquing logic, but there's a difference between logic and the use of logic and rationalism. Empiricism is not just a belief in natural science. It's a commitment to natural science as the only method of knowledge. Or rationalism is a pre-commitment to reason as the foundational method of knowing what we know. That it's reason alone that we can get to God. Not God transcends, like mathematics and ethics transcends the world. God transcends the world, but we can get to God on our own through rationale, through syllogisms and rational thinking. Plato, that's what he was. He's a rationalist. And Plato doubted the material world because the material world, one thing he observed about the material world, that was always in flux. It was always changing. The world was never the same. And therefore, because it's always changing, how can it be certain, or how can it be eternal? How can it be something that's for really real? But one thing he noticed that wasn't changing, 2 + 2 = 4 is something that's absolute, something that doesn't change. And thus he come to the conclusion that the mind and the thoughts of mind, and he called it the forms, but logic and the absolute truths that are within the mind are more real than the universe, more real than matter. Now, he didn't completely say matter does not exist. He just said that the mind is more important and more real, or at least the concepts within the mind is more real than that which is made out of matter. In the end, he reversed things. He said the world is more of an illusion. We may think the world is tangible and our memories and our thinking is illusion, but he says it's actually the opposite. And he gave this illustration of being in a cave and we're seeing shadows. The shadows that we see are the physical objects. He said, this is a shadow, this pulpit, podium. And you, as a kid, you go, no, this is not a shadow. This is real. I can touch it. No, Plato said, no, this is the shadow. The reality, what is really real is that which is in the mind. And this is just a representation of that which is in the mind. And that which is in the mind is something eternal. It's not. It doesn't exist in your mind. It exists in some higher mind, some transcendent area. The forms exist. But in the problem with that theory, he couldn't really explain the physical world. Empiricists can't explain mathematics, but rationalists have a hard time explaining matter. There's no explanation for why matter exists. René Descartes is another principal rationalist, and he's a man who says, I think, therefore I am. But the original way he said it was, I doubt, therefore I am. It wasn't the positive. He changed it later to sound more optimistic, I think. But originally it was, I doubt. And so he said, I don't know anything. Have you ever got to a point where you said, I just don't know anything anymore? Maybe you're experienced in your field and you made a mistake, and then you go, man, I don't know. I don't even know if I know the basics anymore. Well, Rene Descartes was a genius. He was a mathematician. And he came to a point where he questioned everything. He questioned his own existence. I mean, I don't even know if I'm real. I may be a figment of my own imagination, or I might be a figment of your imagination. I have no clue. I can't be certain of anything. I doubt everything. I don't know anything. I'm a pure agnostic when it comes to knowledge. I doubt everything. But in doubting, he says, I doubt, but in doubting, I can't doubt that I doubt. Well, I know one thing, I'm a doubter. So he's like, okay, I don't doubt everything anymore, I know something. He came to some truth that he is a doubter. But in coming to the truth that he's a doubter, he concluded that, you know, thought, that the fact that he's doubting is a thought, that I think, you know, that she turned it to a positive thing. I think, because I think, therefore I am. I exist. I can conclude that I exist. And then he said, well, I don't know if you exist, but I know that I exist. Well, then he tried to get to God. It's kind of through the ontological reasoning, but basically he got to God this way. He says, you know, something greater, something lesser cannot produce something greater. That seems like a logical, sensible thought. The lesser comes from the greater, not the reverse. He says, I can't be God myself because I'm a doubter. You know, I'm a doubter. I may not even exist. So I can't say I'm God. But the fact that I can think of a God must mean the thought of a God who doesn't doubt, a God that's perfect in every way, the fact that I can think of a God must mean that that thought couldn't have risen from me. I couldn't be the origin of that thought, because I'm a lesser being than the thought of that which is greater. Thus, that greater thought of God has to be from God himself. Thus, I believe I am, I think therefore I am, I think therefore God is. Or I think that there's a God, therefore God is. That's Rene Descartes. Okay, well, maybe that's good and clever and all, but Rene Descartes still had a problem with the world. He tried to explain the one, but really couldn't get to the many. So this is the great philosophical problem, which is ultimate, one or the many. Is it how do you explain the one if you start with the many, and how do you explain the many if you start with the one? And it seems to be that science or empiricism and rationalism are just going to be eternally at odds with one another. And throughout philosophy, the great thinkers of the world, you've got Plato, who's a rationalist, you've got Aristotle, who was an empiricist, you know, they're conflicting with one another. And so maybe both of these methods, philosophy, rationalism, empiricism, natural science, doesn't get us to God. Maybe we need to combine them. Now that'll do it. If rationalism gets us to God but not to the world, and if empiricism gets us to the world but not to God, if we get them together, marry them, now we'll get to God. Well, that's called natural religion. It's a branch of philosophy, and it's also called by many natural theology. Now, don't confuse natural theology with natural revelation or general revelation. We'll talk about that tomorrow. But when I'm using the phrase natural theology, all I mean by it in this lecture or this class, all I mean by it is that it's a philosophy of combining natural science with philosophy. Bring rationalism and empiricism together, and voila, you get natural religion. You can get to God from the ground up. We can start with the self, start with you. We're in the fish tank, and we can just tell us what everything that's outside the fish tank if we use these two disciplines together. Well, in one way, the guy who did this was a man named Aristotle. And Thomas Aquinas was a medieval Catholic theologian who implemented the philosophy and the natural science of Aristotle, and sought to develop what we call the cosmological argument for not only the existence of God, and I do think it gets us to the existence of God, but he tried to use this argument to get us to the nature of God, who God is. And I think he ends up creating the wrong God. Now, Aristotle is the one, now put your thinking caps on for a second. Aristotle is the one that kind of coined the word. He didn't coin it, but the people who compiled the writings of Aristotle coined the phrase metaphysics. It's a big word. You probably have heard of it, but it's really simple to understand. Aristotle was a scientist. Most of his writings dealt with science, and he studied animals and birds, insects. He just wrote all these books about what he observed. And so he was one who observed the universe and wrote what he observed. And most of his writings dealing with physics, the physical world, science. But he also speculated about the things that transcend science. And those who compiled the writings of Aristotle didn't know what to do with, okay, he's got several books on things that are not dealing with birds and animals and the stars and the planets and the motions of the universe. And they said, let's just put that at the end, you know, at the end of the books. Let's put that after physics. And that's the Greek word meta means after. So it's after the physics, stuff that comes after physics. Well, it's metaphysics, that which comes after physics is good because it's not only kind of interesting that it was coined because this is the books that come after the physics, but actually it's cool because that's how Aristotle sought to understand who God is. He started with natural science, and when natural science comes up to the edge of the fishbowl and can't go any further, he goes, now let's bring in reason. Now let's bring in philosophy. Now we have to jump out of the fishbowl. Science gets us to the edge. Now let's move beyond that edge through some philosophical assumptions. Now, the way he got to God is through the cosmological argument, and it's simply this. Everything in the physical universe is in motion. Now, that's true. Second premise, everything in motion is set in motion by something else in motion. That's also true. Therefore, this can't logically keep going back and back and back indefinitely. There's no explanation if there's no first cause. Therefore, logically, there has to be the first unmoved mover, or there has to be a first cause that itself, the cause that didn't need to be put in motion. And that first cause, which he says is God, is what put everything in motion. And thus, we have a pretty neat little syllogism that gets us to the nature, and not just to the existence of God, but the nature of God. Now, let's walk through that real quickly. Now, so he's mainly a physicist. He's a scientist, and he's studying the universe, and he noticed that everything in the universe is in motion. And thus, everything in motion is set in motion by something else. Therefore, everything in motion is finite. So everything that you see that's moving, if it's a dog or an animal or the stars, or at least the planets that are in rotation, everything that's in motion has to be set in motion by something else. And he said, everything that is in motion is divisible. It's not simple. It's complex. And this is a key one. Everything in motion, everything in the physical world that is in motion is moving between two antithetical points. Things don't move randomly. They move from polar opposites. It goes from hot to brown. Now, it doesn't go to hot to brown, right? It goes from hot to cold. You go from small to large, right? You don't go small to green. You don't go small to hot. But all movement is between two antithetical points. That's a huge thing to remember as we go on. Aristotle says eventually one thing cannot have more than one contrary. So everything in motion is going from one thing into the opposite of what it is. It's going from one thing and eventually ceases, like light goes to darkness. But once it's darkness, it's no longer what it used to be. It's the complete opposite. Everything is moving into its opposite. He says, change is not found in all things, but only between contraries and between two things that are contradictory. Thus, motion requires mutability. Things are either moving to the better, things are becoming better, or things becoming worse. Then nothing's staying the same. Everything moving to something greater, you know. And so he gets that everything in motion in the world is either decaying or maturing. Everything in motion, he says, is changed from one thing into something else. Thus, everything in motion requires things that are deficient. There's nothing that is in motion that is moving in the universe that is perfect. If it was perfect, it wouldn't be moving anymore. Therefore, everything in motion is imperfect. Something wrong. Motion becomes something that's bad, or at least is an indication of something that is not good. And motion requires a mover. So this gets us to, in his mind, from science, it gets us to God. This is where you go from physical science and you're at the edge of the fishbowl. It's like, okay, now let's jump out of the fishbowl. Let's cross that transcendental wall. And now we know not that God exists. We know something about God. What is God? Well, he can't be in motion. He's unmovable. If he was in motion, then who put him in motion? It's like, well, who created God? No one created God, Aristotle said. No one put him in motion because he's not moving. He's stagnant. He's stuck. He's not in time, right? He's outside of time. He's just still. He's there. Well, he's not mutable. He's immutable. He's not mobile. He's immobile. He's not complex. He's simple. He's not in time. He's timeless. He's not dependent. He's independent. And we go, wait a minute, that sounds like the God of the Bible. There's a lot of attributes that Aristotle concluded that is true with the biblical God. God is immutable. We believe that he doesn't change. We believe that, you know, there's some, I don't fully understand God's relationship with time, but it's not like my relationship with time. And so it seems like not only do we get to the existence of God through science in this philosophical leap, we seem to get to some of the attributes of God. Now, this is known as the way of causation, getting to God through the causal relationships of the physical universe. It's the way of causation. And the way of causation in philosophy terms leads to two other ways of knowing God. It's the way of immanence and the way of transcendence. That way, the way of causation is that we know God by knowing something of how cause and effects works in the universe. That means that God is similar to the things that are made in the universe, but he's different. Now, remember that one thing I told you to remember, that everything in the universe is moving from, is not jumping like this, but moving in a line between polar opposites from hot to cold. And if God is the ultimate first cause, then everything is in motion, is set in motion by God, and therefore everything in motion represents God in some way. Now, we know we're made in the image of God, but Thomas Aquinas, who used this argument, says, yeah, everything, not just humanity, but everything reflects God in some ways. In some ways, everything is the opposite of God. So if everything looks like God in some ways and everything doesn't look like God in other ways, you have this kind of the way of causation leads to a way of immanence. There's some similarities and there's a way of diversity or difference. But in the end, everything has come from God. In the end, the way of transcendence overcomes the ways of immanence because God is the opposite, right? He's the complete opposite of everything in motion. And what is that? Well, we don't know. We can't know. I mean, and he's a simple being because he's not made of diversity, right? He's undifferentiated simplicity. And if you take of all of God's attributes and ball it up and mix it again with a blender, and God's wrath and God's holiness and God's love and God's mercy and God's goodness, everything that God is and put it in together and say it's all one thing, then what is that one thing? Well, you don't know. You might say God is unknowable. In the end, Aristotle will come to a knowledge of God, but in trying to define who God is by studying creation, he ended up creating a God that's completely undefinable, a deistic God. Because the God of Aristotle is a God that could not have created the universe. Because he can't move. Now, Aristotle didn't think that God created the universe, by the way. He didn't have a Bible, and he didn't have to fit his philosophy in with the scriptures, that God created the universe out of nothing. No, he believed the universe was eternal. And that there's two eternal necessary existence. You have the particulars, you have the one. You have God and you have the universe. And that they're both necessary. Because you can't have God who's unmovable and without motion ever being the moving cause of the universe. So he didn't say that God moved the universe. He says that God moves the universe, but how does an unmovable God move the universe, according to Aristotle? Well, he doesn't move it by an act of the will or exertion of power. Because if he exerted power or had an act of the will, that would be a change. That would be a movement in God. God would do something. And doing something would be going from a state of not doing something to a state of doing something. And then he would no longer be the unmoved mover. Well, how does the unmoved mover move? He moves like a magnet. A magnet can sit there not knowingly attract other things to itself. But the magnet can be completely unaware of other things being drawn to it. So God is the perfect being, an unknowable, simple being that we can't comprehend. And all the world is trying to become perfect. All the world is a movement trying to become like God. And thus we're imperfect, but we're trying to become perfect. We're trying to actualize ourselves into pure activity, a pure actualization of who God is. And so the God is moving the world, but God is deistic. God doesn't know what he's doing. And what does a simple being who cannot move do? The only thing he can do is contemplate himself in a timeless act of self-contemplation, because he can't know himself and that which is not himself, because that would be a differentiation right within his mind. So he's this pure, simple being who ends up being an unknowable God who can't create, who's deistic. He's so transcendent, he can't be the God of the Bible. And so here's my point, and this is so important for us to see. Now, you may be tempted to use the cosmological argument with your atheistic friends or your agnostic friends and say, listen, I got a rationale that you can't deny. But you may use that logic. But you don't get to the God of the Bible. You get to probably deism, maybe pantheism. But you don't get to a God who created the universe out of nothing. A God who can speak. A God who can have free acts of the will. So this is what you get when you get philosophy and empiricism or natural science collected together. What does it teach us? Well, I'm going to talk to you about tomorrow in the morning. I'm going to talk about how there are two things that's hard to reconcile. God's transcendence, how he's separate from the universe. He created the universe out of nothing. He's not a part of the universe. We don't believe in pantheism where God is in everything or God is everything. This is not God. He created everything out of the free act of the will, but God is not this universe. He's transcendent. He's outside. He's self-contained outside this universe. So he's transcendent. But we also believe in providence, that God is with us. He's near. He speaks to us. He walks with us. He talks with us through the scriptures. He communes with us. He's near us. He's not an absentee landlord. We believe in the doctrine of providence, that God is not a part of creation, but he's in creation. That is, at least he's omnipresent. He's here. How can both doctrines be true? God's transcendence and God's immanence. Well, science can't explain it. Empiricism might get to an immanence that God is part of creation. Rationalism might get God's transcendence, but you can't get both ands. You can't get a God who's outside of creation and a God who is providentially controlling creation. You can't get both, but that's the God of the Bible. How do you get to the God of the Bible? Well, you don't use these three methods. The problem with natural theology, if I can reduce it down to this simple problem, it's built upon a faulty presupposition. Science doesn't tell us this, but it's built upon this assumption that the cause and effect reality in this world transcends all the way back and reaches all the way back to God, that we can know how motion moves within the universe, thus we can know how motion would move in God if God had motion. It's like, no, we can't say that. We don't know that. God's completely outside of creation, so we can't study this creation and come to the conclusion this way God must be. We don't know. We're in the fishbowl. What do we need? Revelation. We're dependent, weak creatures. See, the problem with even Christians trying to use these methods to prove God's essence, nature, his existence and his essence and his nature, is it puts us in control of our knowledge. We're not sufficient to work our way to God. It is in the wisdom of God. Now, he's designed this. He is so wise. He says that man in his wisdom, our best scholars, our best thinkers, our best philosophers, man in his wisdom cannot know God. We're left blind. We're left ignorant. We need revelation. Now, tomorrow morning, we'll talk about how God has not left us without a revelation. He's communicated the whole human race through natural revelation that he exists. He's communicated certain attributes about who he is. Man knows there's a God. He's not without excuse. But the reason man knows that there is a God is because God has revealed himself. God has communicated to us. Thus, we do not, in our own autonomy, think that we can get to God. We have to submit to God. Knowledge of God begins on our knees. It begins with submission, not with an achievement. It's submission to what God has told us, not trying to say, I can get to God on my own. When we reject what God has communicated and try to get to God on our own, we will create an idol in our lives. We will create a false God. So we need divine revelation. Listen to these verses as I close. 1 Corinthians 2:13, when we tell you these things, we do not use words that come from human wisdom. Instead, we speak words given to us by the Spirit, using the Spirit's word to explain spiritual truths. Jeremiah 8:9, the wise will be put to shame. They will be dismayed and trapped since they have rejected the word of the Lord. What kind of wisdom do they have? Aristotle, Plato. The youngest believer in this room, the most immature Christian, knows more than the philosophers. Colossians 2:7-8. Let your root grow down into him and let your lives be built on him. Then your faith will grow strong in the truth you were taught, and you will overflow with thankfulness. Do not let anyone capture you with empty philosophies and high-sounding nonsense that come from human thinking and from the spiritual powers of this world. The Bible talks about there are two types of wisdom. Now, I'm not against philosophy altogether, because philosophy is asking questions. The Bible answers those questions. Revelation answers those questions. God communicates the answers to that. So I'm for answering the tough questions, which is ultimate, the one or the many, or how God can be transcendent and immanent. These are difficult questions, or what is the meaning of life? All these things philosophers want to know, but they can't arrive to the right answers. Because there are two types of wisdoms. There's the wisdom that comes from above, and James says there's the wisdom that comes from below. And the wisdom that comes from below is earthly, even the Bible would say demonic. But the wisdom that comes from above is spiritual, it's heavenly. And the beginning of wisdom is not self-autonomy. I can get to my own God. I don't need God to tell me who he is. I'll discover him on my own. No, that's not the beginning of wisdom. That's the beginning of foolishness. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. You start with God to know God. You don't end with God. God has already communicated himself to man. We know there's a God. We know certain attributes of God. We don't have to come to that conclusion. We submit to that conclusion. Let's pray. Dear Lord, we do want to know how to know you properly, and we don't want to be given to worldly philosophies and the wisdom of this world. We don't want to be entrapped with the philosophies of the world. No matter how clever they sound and how wise they sound, we know, dear God, the true wisdom is a wisdom that's from above. It comes through divine revelation. We need you to speak to us, or we're left in the fishbowl in our own blindness and darkness. Thank you for giving us revelation in which we are completely dependent upon. This we pray in your Son's name. Amen.
We hope that you were edified by this message. For additional sermons as well as information on giving to the ministry of Grace Community Church, please visit us online at gracenevada.com. That's gracenevada.com.